Hi, my name is Annie Hartnett, and I'm the author of the new book, The Road to Tender Hearts, and also Unlikely Animals and Rabbit Cake.
Annie Hartnett's new novel, The Road to Tender Hearts, is difficult to categorize. It's probably best described as a dark comedy with a touch of magical realism. It's definitely one of a kind. The story follows 60-something PJ on a journey west to reunite with an old high school flame. And along the way, he's unexpectedly joined by his brother's grandchildren, his own grown daughter, and a cat that predicts death. And there's certainly a lot of death. I recently spoke with Annie Hartnett about the inspiration behind the book and her unique voice that blends the true-to-life issues of loss and pain with a hint of magic. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Annie Hartnett. So can you introduce The Road to Tender Hearts to our listeners? I mean, it has a lot going on, but maybe you have an elevator speech for it?
So The Road to Tender Hearts is about an older man named PJ Holiday, who is reading the obituaries one morning when he comes across the obituary for his high school buddy. And he realizes that if that man is dead, then the woman that that man married is single again. So he decides to get in his car to win back this woman he had a crush on 45 years ago. But before he can leave, he ends up with the surprise custody of his great niece and great nephew. And so he decides to take them along for the trip. Then his daughter, his semi-estranged daughter, is worried about her father and these kids. So she comes along. And also along for the trip is a cat named Pancakes, who can predict death. We would be on the 11th floor by now if we were an elevator. Slow elevator, too. But
so this book has an ever-growing cast of characters, but for the most part, they all revolve around PJ, who is quite the unlikely hero. Where did his story start for you?
His story started at the newspaper. So the newspaper that he's reading in the beginning of the story is something that I stole from real life. I met a man who was a theater professor and a very sweet, sensitive guy. And he told me that his wife cuts up the newspaper for him every morning and that she removes anything that would upset him about small children or animals. And I, like, you know, I asked him a few more questions about it, but I didn't know him well, so wasn't able to really, like, what does the newspaper look like? Like, how early does she get up in the morning? And I couldn't forget about it because it was both an endearing detail and also I was like, who loves someone that much to cut up the newspaper that every morning? Who needs that much care and attention that demands their newspaper be cut up every morning? So PJ started there with a man whose newspaper was cut up every morning. In The Road to Tender Hearts, it's done by his ex-wife. So he has breakfast every morning with his ex-wife and her new boyfriend. So they have sort of a unconventional friendship, but she still does this gesture of love for him. And then PJ is also somewhat based on my own father, who I named PJ after. My dad is also Paul John Hartnett, and I often call him PJH. So I put another PJH, Paul John Holiday, Paul John Hartnett. And he's similar to my dad, and my dad is extremely generous and very gregarious. There's a line in the book where PJ Holiday is called the mayor of the town just by the people at the bar. And that is something that my dad is called in his town. So, and then he's also somewhat based, and readers are picking up on this both because of the cover and because of a couple of details, but he's somewhat based on the dude from The Big Lebowski. So people notice that with the Birkenstocks and the shorts do that. So he's a somewhat sad character, He's an alcoholic. He's a hoarder. His daughter died 15 years ago. His wife left him. But he is like at his core a lovely guy and really does want what's best for the world. Like he won the lottery. He won $1.5 million in a scratch ticket that he doesn't remember buying because he was so drunk. And he gives it away to sort of anyone who asks for it, which is something that is based on my dad's generosity. I keep telling people my dad doesn't spend that much time on the internet, so I'm like, don't tell my dad about GoFundMe, please. My dad will like he you know once saw a sad story on the news about a racist incident at a Chinese restaurant, and he's send immediately sends a check in the mail to and becomes friends with the owner, and not even in our town, and he also has a lot of anxiety about what life would be like if he did win the lottery. So he'll play the Powerball every so often, and then he'll call me, and he'll just have to walk through who he's going to give money to, like how he's going to divide, like your aunt gets this much, your uncle will get this much, you kids will get this much. And I'm like, Dad, you didn't win, and you're not going to win the Powerball. So knowing that, and then reading about PJ Holiday, you'll see a little bit about my dad.
So is he the gentleman in your epigraph who was quoted as shut up and look out the window?
Yes, the epigraph is "Shut up and look out the window." PJ Hartnett said on every road trip. Which is really the only time that we went on a big family road trip is we the only time we went on an international trip at all was we went to Ireland for a month, and there Irish cars are so small because Irish roads are so twisty tiny, so we had been used to a minivan, and there were three kids in the back seat and then my parents in the front, and it was just this tiny car, and we were always fighting back there. And my dad kept saying, "Shut up and look out the window," which was like, and some parts of Ireland, we'd be like, "All we can see are hedges and sheep." So it's a famous family saying.
I don't want to pigeonhole this book into one genre, so I'll ask about a few. I saw this book described as a dark comedy, and you just mentioned that, PJ in the book goes to his wife's house every morning for breakfast, and she cuts out the newspaper for him. But it's also like proof of life. It's meant to be a proof of life thing. So it's, there's dry humor, there are dark moments, they're complemented with some laugh out loud quips and entertaining adventures. Did this blend of the light with the heavy come natural to you?
Yeah, that is definitely my personality. And I agree that it's not so easy to like someone else called it like uplit to me, which is a category that I think is like an uplifting, and it is an uplifting book, but it doesn't quite fit on the shelf with some of the other books that you would more easily classify as uplit. I think of it as a dark comedy because that's kind of how I think of myself as a person with a dark sense of humor. It is something that has always kind of come naturally to me. I always go for the joke when I'm sad or when I'm going through something difficult. I think that is somewhat from, I mean, it's definitely a lot from my family. My family is Irish Catholic. There is that dark humor that is from that sort of upbringing. I also grew up in a town. Which is, and I'm married to a Jewish man. There's a lot of overlap, I think, between Jewish humor and Irish humor that's like a little bit, not always appropriate, about for the moment. And so those are some of my like influences in humor, but it's also a personality thing, is it's how I see my role in the world, is like I'm the one that makes the joke that breaks up the tension. But I am really sensitive, and I've always been worried about where I've been a vegetarian since I was six. So I've always been sort of like, worried about animals. And in some ways I am PJ. I want my newspaper cut up about, I want the animals and the small children taken out of the newspaper, except I've never been able to look away from the horrors of the world. So it's both, the darkness is things I worry about. The book is so much about things I have anxiety about, and then how I cope with it is humor. So it's a real pairing of anxiety and humor.
I was also thinking, it has a bit of magical realism, with the agent of death cat, the talking hat and the like, or, were the talking hat and house part of PJ's imagination?
Yes. So at the beginning, the hat talks, he has a baseball hat that belonged to his daughter who died 15 years ago, who talks to him, and his house talks to him. And there's this line that's like, a house will talk back to anyone who lives there long enough. And I think it's really what I'm like, anyone who's lonely enough, like, things will start to have, an extra meaning. PJ is very lonely at the beginning. He does spend every day at the bar, but he's really lonely and lost. So the magic realism is both ways to sort of say he's lonely without directly saying he's lonely. And also, I just love magic realism because I like fiction to be more than real life. And it's very hard for me to just write straight realism because I'm just always trying to, I'm trying to make myself laugh. I'm trying to make myself like wow. And magic just does that for me. So the town that PJ lives in is called Pondville, and I live in Lakeville. So I take both the real Lakeville, which is a small town in Massachusetts, a very ordinary town, and there's a pond in the town called Clear Pond, which, and then I put a mermaid in it, So it makes it just a little more fun. And yeah, not too much magic realism, but just enough to kind of amuse myself, and hopefully readers.
So we have to talk about death, from Pancakes, the predicting death cat, to the loss of PJ's daughter, to, the murder-suicide scene and everything in between. I lost track of how many, mainly minor characters died. In the section at the end, Pancakes thinks, "Death is a magnificent invention because it's the impermanence of life that makes it beautiful." Talk to me about how you approach death in the novel.
So the first character you meet is Pancakes the cat. Someone I who interviewed me recently told me that Pancakes is the main character. And I was like, that's not quite true. PJ's the main character. But it is, I teach writing and I would usually say the first character you meet is should be your main character. So on the other hand, I'm like, maybe she's not wrong. But the first character you meet is Pancakes the cat, who is based on a real cat who was a nursing home cat in Rhode Island named Oscar. And Oscar, when he was alive, was a therapy cat in this nursing home, and he predicted over 100 deaths. So Pancakes is based on that cat, with that ability, although in my book, the cat gets kicked out of the nursing home because the people who live in the nursing home don't like to know that they're about to die, and it terrifies them that there's a grim reaper walking around picking them off one by one. So Pancakes gets taken to the shelter. And so the reader knows the whole time that the cat has this ability. PJ and the rest of the crew do not know that he has the ability. So Pancakes is the one who knows that death is all around them. And Pancakes gave me so much freedom in terms of putting in this light tone about death and about the danger that's all around them. And just allows me to do that, the same thing that magic realism allows me to do. It allows me to make the book more than a real life. And so Pancakes has an interesting perspective on death, as you just read and what he says late in the book, that everybody dies, and that's something we all get. And It's, I did want to write a book about that death is all around us, that danger is all around us, but that isn't like it isn't a good reason to lock yourself in your house and never leave. And so pancakes, and generally how I write animals is that they have a like a wiser perspective on life. This is my first time writing a cat character. In my last book, Unlikely Animals, there's a lot from the perspective of a dog. And his perspective is much like people should just love each other. That's, you know, like that's what dogs think. And they're so immediate. But my imaginary cats definitely have more of a like, there's a line there that is that all cats, all dogs are born a clean slate, and all cats are born with a ancient knowledge. So I wanted to play with that, that cats have the sort of like Egyptian wisdom. And yeah, the pancakes lets me get away with the tone, the dark comedy, and allow us to have a lot of fun with a book that has an extremely high body count. Like, I think this is, it's definitely the most people that I will ever kill in a book that I also wanted to make. My challenge to myself was to try to make as many bad things happen and to try to make it my funniest book yet.
What can children teach adults in times of grief? And I'm thinking about Ollie and Luna, but also Sophie.
Yeah, so Ollie and Luna, all my books have so far, I have three books, and they all have children characters who are about the same age. They're fourth or fifth graders. And I think I love that age in particular because they are, and I used to teach in a non-traditional setting, but I used to teach fifth graders. And I love that age because they're so, they know so many things about the world, and they are also still total babies. And so I love that mixture of, I really love that all children are experts in something. Like, truly, every fifth grader you meet, and even children smaller than that, are really experts in one thing that they later will completely lose. Like, you'll meet kids who can tell you every kind of dump truck and every kind of like the make and model of every construction vehicle. And then for me, I knew I could have done like a graduate level like diagram of horse anatomy, you know, and I don't remember that at all now. But children know so many things about the world, and they're really sensitive, and they notice things that adults don't. And sometimes they have really simple solutions that adults can't see. And they also have it's their first time experiencing something, and they have not always, if children go through a death of a loved one, like I remember when I was four, my great aunt died. I was like, she gets her name in the paper. She's famous. Like, why is everyone sad? This is like her greatest moment. She gets to be in the newspaper. So children have a different perspective on the world. And then Sophie, who's a character who's in her 20s, she's much more of an adult than her father is. And I think she has a real perspective on, she still remembers what children need. Her character, one real purpose she serves in the story is to make sure that the children are taken care of. And some of that is just because she remembers so much, which she didn't have as a child. And she existed in the story to make sure that you didn't feel too much in danger about the children, because PJ is not your ideal caretaker by any stretch.
Another idea you wrote about that captured my attention. This was from a minor character, a Waffle House cook named Brandon. His father had told him that, and this is a quote, "A person needs three things to be happy: something to do, someone to love, and something to look forward to." There's some truth to that statement, isn't there?
I'm so glad that you asked me about that. That is given by a unconventional character, Brandon, the Waffle House cook, but it is actually advice from my next door neighbor growing up. I had two next door neighbors growing up who were like, an additional set of grandparents, Dr. Chris and Mrs. Chris. And they were just very special to me. I mean, Mrs. Chris is still alive. And Dr. Chris died about 2 years ago. And they both lived into their 90s and or lives. One of them's still alive and she's still like as sharp as a tack. And they have lived like someone asked me recently, well, like who does retirement well? We were talking about our parents, like who does it well? No one does it well. And I was like, there are people that do it well. And the Chris's did it well. And they took Italian lessons to go to Italy. Dr. Chris played the piano. He was this renowned cardiologist. And they had four children of their own. They adopted another one. And Mrs. Chris would, every Wednesday after her kids were grown, she would have me and two other kids over to her house for reading club. And she would read aloud to us starting from first grade on. And she would serve cookies and juice. And every Wednesday she would read to us for an hour. And then we turned it into writing club once we got into middle school. And so that was the sort of beginning of like my whole literary career. And Dr. Chris gave me when he found out I really was interested in writing, he gave me E.B. White's essays to read. And they're just really special people. And so Dr. Chris, his advice was everyone needs something to do, someone to love, and something to look forward to. And I thought it was so special, but I had to find a way to share it in a way that would work for the story. So it's given by the Waffle House cook.
You already mentioned how you wrote a book that featured a dog's perspective, and this one has a cat's perspective. But there's also like the alpaca farm and the alligator, and this seems to be a common thread. So can you talk to me about the importance of animals in your life?
Yeah. With my first book, Rabbit Cake, there's a lot of animals in that book. The little girl is obsessed with animals and she works at a zoo. With Unlikely Animals, again, there's a lot of animals in that book, as you see in the title. And The Road to Tender Hearts, I was like, all right, maybe I got to pump the brakes a little bit. But my editor had said, you know, people expect animals in an Annie Hartnett book. It's okay. It's like, it's dark comedy and animals. Those are what you're going to get. I have always loved animals. I love the natural world. I've always been the person who's like, I would rather meet your dog than meet your baby. Like, I'm really excited about animals. In writing a little bit of magic realism, animals give me, like, there is a real magic to animals. There are so many things we don't understand about animals, why they are so in tune with us, what they know, what they think. I have a friend who, she had sleep paralysis in the middle of the night. She woke up and she was, you know, paralyzed and couldn't move, couldn't do anything, couldn't talk. And all of a sudden she hears her dog flop off the couch and trot from, you know, the living room to her bedroom and come and lie on top of her. And that broke the spell of the sleep paralysis. And so stories like that, it's like, how would the dog, you know, she didn't call for the dog. How does the dog know that? And so that sort of like woo-woo, sixth sense, the world is much more magical than we understand. Like, that's what I can't resist about animals. It's just the unknown. And, you know, there's much more to this world than humans. And humans don't always make me feel good about the world. And so animals always do. I usually write outside during nice weather. I sit outside of my back porch under my hummingbird feeder. And it's like the fact that those little tiny creatures with heart, like it's like a heartbeat and wings, and like that they exist and that they have personalities. Like if I don't fill the hummingbird feeder every day, the hummingbird taps on the glass of my door. Like it's amazing. And so the thing about fiction writing is it makes you pay attention. And so it makes me pay attention to the things that I like to pay attention to, which is animals. And then I like to do a big comic, you know, the ways that an alligator can make things go wrong are can be a lot of fun. So that's not a spoiler, but you'll see what happens with the alligator.
This is a slightly related follow-up. When this group of travelers, they stopped at the largest alpaca farm in that part of Kentucky, Big Kevin from the farm said of the noise that the alpacas were making, "Sounds like a bad high school band, don't they?" And Sophie thought she loved the description, a band of alpacas. Now, I geek out over collective nouns. Is that the collective noun for an alpaca, a band?
No, I don't think so.
Darn.
But they are described, like, if you can watch videos of them humming, and they do sound like, you know, awful, but they hum, and they're very, they can be very talkative, but they don't, I don't know what you would think an alpaca sounds like, but they don't sound like, I mean, I had kind of thought they were probably like giraffes. Like, nobody knows what they sound like. They don't sound like anything at all, but they really hum. And there was a version of the book, which is not the version of the book that's printed, but that they were able to sing Christmas carols. But I took that out. That was too far magical realism.
You host a podcast called Good Moms on Paper about writing and parenting. And The Road to Tender Hearts is certainly a story about parenting, albeit without the traditional mother role. Did your podcast help form how you crafted PJ or even Sophie as a parental figure?
I would say the podcast does not help with my writing at all. The podcast, I love the podcast. The podcast, I edit the podcast and I do the guests. So the podcast takes time. But I like the podcast. The podcast is a real social outlet for me. But parenting, which is the podcast is about writing and parenting. The book, this book to me, The Road to Tender Hearts, is about parenting. And because my daughter was 2 when I started this book, and she's 5 now. And when we were... Well, I hadn't started the book yet, but we moved out to Lakeville from, we had been living in Providence, and we had been living in this house. We had lived happily in Providence, I should say, for 4 years. And then we moved to a house in Providence that was just, that house tried to kill us in any way that it could think of. It was a, we moved in 2020. And the house had 2 gas leaks, 2 basement floods. We had rats that got into our car and caused $1,400 in damage. We had a teenager crash his car at the base of our driveway and die. And his whole family would come out every night and have a candlelight vigil at the base of our driveway at this very busy street. So I was like, they're all gonna get run over. And then, you know, the rat guy came and said, don't let your 2-year-old daughter run at the rats because the rats will just run at her right back. And I'm like, this child doesn't speak English. Like, she's going to do whatever she wants to do. And then we had the mulberry tree cut down. We didn't own the house. So everything, we had to go through the landlord. We had the mulberry tree cut down that was bringing all the rats to the yard. And then the arborist said, oh, you've got those trees, that tree, those trees are all going to fall in the house. And then we had black mold and we had lead in the water. And it was just like every possible thing. So we broke our lease and left. And the landlord did fix a bunch of things before the next tenant moved in. But then the tenant happened to know my sister-in-law and she got some of my mail. So she sent me an Instagram message and she asked me if I had any paranormal experiences in the house. Can you believe? So that is where, like, that was my emotional state in writing this book, that I was on the run from every bad thing that I could possibly imagine happening while trying to do a good job taking care of a small child. And so that's sort of the background. Like, I think that does make the book, like, make emotional sense of what, I don't really write about my own life, except I'll take, like, lots of scraps from my own life. But yeah, so the book is about parenting, and the podcast is also about parenting, And also, we like to tell lots of jokes on the podcast. So,
you mentioned that you teach writing, and I was reading in your about the author in the back of the book that you co-run accountability workshops for writers, helping writers commit to routines and embrace the long, slow, joyful, terrible process of doing the work. Can you talk a bit about the workshops?
Yes. The main teaching I do now is through my friend Tessa Fontaine, another great writer, or I shouldn't say another great writer, a great writer. You can decide whether I'm a good writer or not. She and I run accountability workshops. We have been accountability partners ourselves since 2018. And that is really how we have been able to write books, is through relying on each other just to care that we are getting the work done. We don't read each other's work until it's complete. And that is the idea behind the accountability workshops, is that writers need support and coaching, community, but they don't necessarily need the endless feedback that you get in a traditional workshop. Sometimes you do. There's no problem if you do, but I often find that writers should go long stretches where they just think their own thoughts about their own work without any teacher or their peers getting in there and putting their fingers in the stew before it's done. So that's what we started in 3 years ago, and now we have about 80 writers in our groups, and we have their smaller groups. There's the groups of 12 to 15, and we have monthly speakers, and we meet every 2 weeks to like hear what's going on with writers, and then we offer advice. We'll talk about craft stuff. Like, I would tell them the first person in your chapter is your main character, unless it's a cat, and then it might not be. And it's great. And the people are wonderful, and they really support each other, and people get a lot of work done. And it was an experiment we started just to see if it worked for people. And it really does work for people. So come join us, accountabilityworkshops.com.
Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from this book?
My books, generally, I'm like bowled over by how much more readers take away from them than I could possibly have hoped for. The messages I get from people are just like, I really want to amuse people and to like tell a good story and to make people laugh. And sometimes they reach the right people at the right time, and those are the people that send me emails. But I also just feel like it's a little bit of an escapist novel, but it's not so escapist that you're going to feel like you're leaving all the darkness of the world behind. So in some ways it's not escapist, but it's a coping novel about how to laugh. I loved on Amy Poehler's new podcast, she said, "This isn't therapy. I just want everyone to lighten up and have a good time." And that's a little bit how I feel about my books. Although sometimes it's like, well, lightening up and having a good time about hard things like is therapy. So they're not therapy, but I want to hear the lines that make people laugh, and that hopefully it's like an enjoyable trip.
Well, the book is The Road to Tender Hearts. Annie Hartnett, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
That was Annie Hartnett, author of the book, The Road to Tender Hearts, which was published by Ballantine. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.